Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.
Welcome to Secure in Mind, the podcast where Alessandro Longo and Nick Kelly explore the positives and negatives of the development of technology in our rapidly changing world in all areas such as security, privacy, artificial intelligence. And today we have an extremely special guest who I'm honored to speak with. His name is J. Michael Daniel. And we'll explore a bit as to who he is and the area where he's worked over the course of the episode, and hopefully get a sense of how what he's done has impacted the everyday person, and maybe we can take some points away that that we can apply to, say, an Italian context or even a European context as well. But without further ado, welcome to the podcast, Michael.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Excellent. So, look, to kick things off, let's set the stage. If we, I guess, focus on, you know, your background, I over the past couple of episodes that we've done this, I've always been interested as to why someone became interested in this area, specifically cyber. And I guess I've sort of had a bit of a read of your background, and it doesn't seem like the orthodox computer path. So maybe you can give us a walkthrough as to how you came to be where you are.
Sure. Although I would say that anybody who's my age would not have started out their career thinking, I want to do cybersecurity, because that field just almost didn't really exist when I was in high school or college. Mm. But, you know, I've always been interested in technology. I was a fairly early adopter in terms of computer technology and web technology and other things as I was going through. Although my academic background and other things were more on the public policy and trade and finance and that sort of thing. Mm. But the way I ended up in cybersecurity is that in the mid-2000s, I was working for the U.S. government and working on in an agency that deals with how we allocate resources among the different federal agencies called the Office of Management and Budget. And a lot of our agencies, particularly our intelligence agencies and the Defense Department, were starting to spend an enormous amount of money, even by American standards, on this thing called cyber. Yep. And we realized that no one in the budget office, no one at senior levels really understood what we were spending all this money on.
Yeah.
And so a couple of us decided to go get smart on that. As we started learning more and more about it, I became more and more fascinated with this incredibly complex yet really critical issue. And I became convinced that it was something that we really needed to address.
Do you think the background in public policy, there's a lot of overlay indelibly intertwined with the cyber component in any way?
Absolutely. The cybersecurity is not just a technological problem. It is also a business operations problem. It's a human psychology problem. It's an incentives problem, which is exactly what economics is all about. Sort of all, it is a national security problem, all sort of smushed together, that being a technical term.
Works fine.
when you combine all of that, right? You need people who have the hard computer science background looking at this problem, but you also need people who come at this from a human factors side, or you need people who come at this from the economic incentive side and a risk management side in order to actually really tackle the problem effectively.
Out of interest, are there any jobs that you're seeing, are there any professions or professionals that you've spoken to during your times in the administration who came from a purely psychological background who were working on psychological policy in terms of cyber?
Well, there's a company, just as one particular example, yes. There's a company called Endgame based here in Washington, D.C. area. There's a social scientist there named Andrea Limbago, who specializes in sort of not so much straight up psychology, but sort of social science and the social science of how people interact with technology. And that's her specialty, for example. And you're starting to see more and more of that come into the field, which I think is really critical.
Yeah.
you know, I mean, a good example of that is just, you know, for a long time, you know, cybersecurity experts have said, you know, how, you know, what kind of password should you have? Well, you should have a password that's, you know, 16 characters long, that's not in any, that's not a word in any language, that's got, you know, a mixture of numbers and capital letters and squiggly marks and other things. And, you know, the truth is no human can actually remember that. Oh, and by the way, you should have different ones for every single website that you visit. No human can possibly manage that.
Yeah.
And so we've got security experts giving advice that is actually impossible for people to implement. And so you really need to combine that with, so you need to combine the technical advice with an understanding of how people work in order to actually give sensible advice that people could actually follow.
Yeah. And then on top of that, it's not just, you know, the people who aren't involved in security. It's everyone. I'm a security person, but I couldn't remember all those passwords. And yet the difference is I know what a password manager is. Now, if I have a sophisticated adversary, then they would be able to key sniff and figure out the password to my password manager in the first place. But the point being, you can cut away a lot of that low-hanging fruit, just get a password manager.
Absolutely. And that's a piece of advice that I give to my own family and that I would give to anyone is, you know, I come down firmly on the side of using a password manager because, you know, the probability is that, you know, most people are not going to be targeted by a sophisticated actor, and you will really be a lot better off if you're using a password manager. Not to mention less frustrated.
Absolutely, absolutely, and you know that's part of the focus of this podcast. Actually, came from as a slight segue, a discussion to my sister. I mean, she's a specialist HIV doctor, so she's got her own specialty, but she was unfamiliar with what a VPN was. And if you're doing banking on a public Wi-Fi because you can't, your 3G drops out or 4G drops out, for example, and you jump on there, then again, a sophisticated attacker would be out. That's may or may not be an issue, but in the end, a VPN was very useful. And What I realized, and I'm sure what you realized and we'll explore further, is the massive deficit in understanding of basic security hygiene. And when you're talking about hygiene, we're talking about in a comparison in the physical realm, it's like brushing your teeth. You know, you're taught you brush your teeth at a young age. Why doesn't that happen in cyber? So what I would love to do is go back to you mentioned that you came from the public policy background. There was a lot of investment from intelligence agencies in particular into cyber, so you saw that as a really good place to focus on. Describe for the listeners your background in the administrations and where you ended up, which I guess is a big focal point within the Obama administration as the cybersecurity coordinator, I believe.
Yes, so in the spring of 2012, the Obama administration, you know, I was working at the Office of Management and Budget within the U.S. government, and the Obama administration asked me to come serve on the National Security Council staff as special assistant to the president and cybersecurity coordinator.
Wow.
And so that meant that my job was, and I served in that role for 4.5 years from June of 2012 until the end of the administration in January of 2017.
What a privilege. How was it?
you know, it was exciting. It was terrifying. It was exhausting all at the same time. Mm. And, you know, I think that it was an incredibly interesting time to be in that role.
Yeah.
And I had a really bird's eye view of what was happening in cybersecurity policy.
Yeah.
And really, you know, driving the U.S. government to have a more coherent set of policies on cybersecurity, to be able to more effectively use cyber as a tool of national power, but also be able to disrupt what others were trying to do to us and be able to respond to the bad stuff when it happened.
Yep. Can you give us some examples of specific tasks that you had to do, and also maybe one of your daily activities or routines would consist of?
Well, I think that, you know, that's always such a hard thing to do because the job was so varied. You never quite knew exactly what you were going to work on, and you know, one of the things that was sort of a truism was that no matter what your to-do list was, whatever your to-do list was had nothing to do with whatever it was that you actually ended up working on that day.
Yeah.
But I would say that so some of it involved the creation of new policies. So for example, we were worked very hard to help create the presidential direction that instructed the National Institutes of Standards and Technology in the U.S. to develop the cybersecurity framework. And that was a big policy development for us to have the president direct NIST to go and do that work, which I think ultimately produced a really useful product that, you know, executives everywhere can use to help think about cybersecurity within their organization.
Out of interest, have you seen a shift in the mentality in the corporate sector, in the private sector, from executives traditionally not really caring so much about attributing some of their budget into security to actually going, hang on, this is an issue? Have you seen some of that really happen?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when I first started in 2012, we were still trying to convince people that, like, this issue belonged in the boardroom, that it belonged in the White House Situation Room for, you know, as high national security issues. By the time now that's not even a question. I don't run into a single executive that says, I don't think I don't see anyone that says this is not important. What I see now is, okay, you've convinced me, what the hell do I do about it? How do I deal with this problem? What do I do? It's overwhelming. It's bewildering. Help me figure out how to think about it, how to talk about it. That's what I see now.
When you were at Billington, I saw a great presentation that you did at the Billington conference, and you raised there was a three-prong approach to tackle the cyber challenges. I can't remember how long the recording of the video was made, but as far as the three-prong approach is concerned, have you seen any success stories? And again, how can we relate some of these things back into the day-to-day person who's thinking, well, a big data breach in a big bank, it doesn't affect me too much because they're covered by insurance, and yada, yada, yada. You know, both of us would probably know how to actually combat that argument, but how can you sort of pull it back to that the person on the street who doesn't get it, even if they're, even if the executives are getting it now?
Yeah, and I think to me, it's the issue of our digital dependence. Around the world, whether you're talking Western Europe, whether you're talking North America, whether you're talking East Asia, the level of our digital dependence as a society is growing. The number of things that are dependent on the functioning of the internet and cyberspace to provide the goods and services that we want is growing very, very fast.
Yeah.
And it really permeates every bit of people's lives, even if they don't realize it, so that from the electricity that is used to power electronics and lights and houses to the distribution networks that make sure that food is where it's supposed to be, that fuel is where it's supposed to be, that other goods and services are where they're supposed to be. All of that is, the financial services industry, healthcare, anything you can think of is becoming more and more digitally dependent.
Yeah.
And the result is that interruptions to that, disruptions to that are going to become more and more impactful. They're going to have a greater and greater impact on people directly over time. And, just as, if we've been having this conversation, 8-9 years ago, we would have been talking a lot about website defacement.
Yeah.
Right. Like, nobody talks about website defacement anymore as a serious problem.
Yeah, it's an annoyance.
And, it's an annoyance. And I actually think that data breaches are going to be the same way. Like, yes, they're going to still go on, but data breaches are going to be the least of our problems in many ways, in the sense that, corruption of data that imagine like if, as particularly here in the United States, we've been moving to electronic healthcare records.
Yeah.
it's one thing if that record gets stolen, but imagine if somebody got in there and changed your blood type.
Yeah.
And you showed up at the hospital for a procedure and they gave you the wrong kind of blood.
Wow.
You know, that would be potentially life-threatening.
Yeah.
Or imagine now ransomware being used on devices that control things. So you're in a high-rise building and the building gets hit with ransomware and the bad guys say, would you like the elevators turned back on in that building or the air conditioning turned back on in that building? Well, fork over some money. Those are some of the ways that, you know, it can start to actually impact people directly as the bad guys move into the ability to corrupt, or they develop the ability to move into the space of corrupting data or interrupting processes and procedures. And it doesn't even have to be nation states that are doing this. You know, we're reaching the point where criminal groups will easily have these kinds of capabilities.
Yeah, yeah. And that's that, I guess, does put it back into the public sphere of understanding and of it not being so far away or trivial. Well, not trivial, but a web defacement nowadays would be an annoyance as opposed to your pacemaker getting switched on and off because it's because someone's controlling it remotely, or the lifts won't work and therefore you're stuck in the top of a building. That seems to be more relatable. Interested because I've lived in many emerging markets over the years. If you go to, say, a place in Southeast Asia like Cambodia, the level of awareness in some respects is quite high in security, but in other respects it's absolutely appalling. Also, legacy systems make up a massive, massive amount of their infrastructure. And of course, with legacy systems, old technology, there's already been found many, many weaknesses within the security, if any security at all. And also, I'm thinking of another example, which was the Mirai botnet. And for the listeners who are unfamiliar with this, it was a botnet is a many, many, many computers which have been enslaved as part of a command and control system so that hackers can use it to spread malware or to spread spam campaigns, etc. Anyway, this was an IoT, an Internet of Things connected botnet, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was cameras, the security surveillance cameras. Now, I guess the question is, how can we compete against this and how can we turn the tide of poorly secured IoT devices if the economics aren't in our favor? Because I imagine if you're in a Chinese manufacturer or manufacturing plant making these cameras, the incentive for you to increase the amount of money you spend on security researchers picking apart your embedded systems and creating better security firmware for your device certainly doesn't match up to, you know, the fact that you only make 2 cents or 1 cent margin on each camera. And from what some of the discussions that I've had, that seems to be a massive issue. It's the economic. It's the economical drive and an incentive or lack thereof to improve it in different parts of the supply chain.
Yeah, that's unquestionably one of the really big problems that we face is that incentive structure. And so I think that you really have to come at it from both sides so that I think that this is an area where we, you know, education efforts on the part of the public and disclosure efforts on the disclosure requirements on manufacturers to explain some of their processes and whether or not their devices are tested or things like that so that consumers can actually discriminate. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about sort of generating demand for security, but several of us were actually talking recently that even amongst all of us that are like cybersecurity professionals that, you know, live and breathe this stuff, we can't look at an internet connected camera and tell you which one's got better security.
Yeah,
that's an issue. And so, you know, we as a group would probably say, yeah, I'd be willing to spend an extra $2 on a camera if it was demonstrably more secure.
Yeah.
I would certainly do that. Probably I'd spend $10 or $15 for a more secure device, right? Now, I'm an outlier, I recognize, but I bet a lot of people would be willing to spend a little bit more if they could actually make a buying choice on that basis, right?
Exactly. And then again, we're caught in that hamstring. We're caught in the hamstring of economic necessity driving poor security decisions. I don't see that there's any easy answer for this. If there's a great answer at all that's being conceived, I certainly can't see how we could overcome that unless we're facilitating better technology at zero or minimal cost into areas, because we understand that it's a better initiative to furnish and make the investment by providing better security technology, because at the end of the day, that's better than what happens if people in different regions where the economy is driving poor security decisions mean that the tide turns even faster the other way. I don't know. That's...
Yeah, and I think that some of this is, you know, how we ultimately end up deciding to allocate liability as societies, that, you know, some of this is going to be that, you know, I think that you want to allocate liability in a judicious manner, because you don't want to, you know, take all responsibility off of the end user. But I also think that imposing some liability on manufacturers is also reasonable, and you know, and distributors. And so I think that that's going to be a piece of the equation. There's probably going to have to be some additional government interventions,
yep.
If only to drive transparency and disclosure, but maybe even to set standards and for different kinds of equipment. Now, obviously, I think you're going to have a different standard for an internet connected camera than you are for a pacemaker, but I think that there's also going to have to be some government intervention in there. And I think that that is going to be part of how we learn to deal with this new digital world, you know, now that we're much more digital societies. And it really shouldn't surprise anyone that it's taking a while for things to catch up. I mean, you know, I actually think about the fact that my oldest kid is just finished third grade. Mm. And, you know, the iPhone is barely older than him, you know.
It makes us feel old, doesn't it?
Yeah. But it also says, you know, that you know, this thing that has become so ubiquitous, the smartphone, right, even in all those developing places that you're talking about, really is only a decade old.
Yeah.
And that's really not very long in terms of law and policy and other things to get right. I mean, even the web is really only 25 years old, and cyberspace itself you could really only count as maybe 50 years old.
Yeah.
And in terms of sort of international agreements and law and policy, that's really not all that old.
Do you? I would love to focus on some more of your time during the Obama administration days. What were the successes like? What were some of the what were some of the lessons learned when dealing with these very hotly contested, contentious political issues? So, for example, dealing with the Chinese government with some of the manufacturing plants which are providing, which are a part of the supply chain, you're having to contend. I would love for you to expand on how you went about the process, whether successes and failures in discussing at government level, at political level, at executive level during your time in the Obama administration.
Well, I think that we had a tremendous amount of success in restructuring a lot of the policy to provide a good policy foundation for the government.
In the States, though, yes?
Yeah. Yeah, in the States. I think that one of the things that I would say is cybersecurity is and cyber capabilities cannot be considered in a vacuum when you start talking about international relations. Mm. And so, you know, talking about cyber issues with the Chinese, for example, could not be separated from the larger geopolitical context in which we were interacting with the Chinese.
Which makes it all the more difficult.
Absolutely. But at the same time, it also like says that you've got the space for some trades. Mm. And, you know, I think that part of what happened with the Chinese is that we began to make it abundantly clear that our concerns about the theft of intellectual property and the breadth and scope of activity that we could attribute to either individuals or companies in China, or even all the way back to the Chinese government, was really beginning to impact our relationship in other areas. And that was what I think eventually prompted the Chinese to reach an agreement with us on how that, you know, we would not use our intelligence capabilities to steal intellectual property for the benefit of our commercial companies. Now, I'm not naive. It's not that I think that all cyber-enabled Chinese espionage has stopped. Of course, of course it hasn't. But I do think that it made a difference in how each of us, both the U.S. and China, were approaching each other.
And I think communication lines were more open after that, I guess.
Correct, yes. And we're much more able to have discussions. You know, I worked very closely with my counterparts in the UK, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, but Italy and France and Germany as well. Trying to build those connections both at the career staff level within the government between, say, for example, network responders, but also at more senior levels of the government to try to, you know, share information on you know, cyber incidents and, you know, build better coordination on that to promote certain norms of behavior. Because one of the things that I think we need to do is really settle on some rules of the road, if you will, for, you know, things that governments should do and should not do in cyberspace. What activity is acceptable, what activity is not. But the one thing I could definitely say is that, you know, cybersecurity is an international issue, and the kinds of things that people struggle with on cybersecurity are virtually universal.
Yeah.
How it manifests precisely, you know, how it manifests with an American company is going to be different than how it manifests precisely with an Italian company or with a German company or with a Vietnamese company. But many of the issues at their root are actually very similar.
Very interesting. I'd love to see if we can explore now something in the Italian context. Prior to this podcast session, I sent just a tiny bit of information regarding Italy's current setup, and it's complicated. I don't want to overcomplicate things by asking questions about, say, you know, the politics of the country, which is still settling in. But let's say we summarize the situation as a country which maybe is a bit lost in terms of where it needs to head, where it needs to go, security policy-wise, security construct-wise, in terms of the different... different departments, institutions, the communication amongst all, also the adherence and how to mobilize a newly elected, a newly installed government into a position where they're going to be comfortable and ready to adhere to certain policy changes and interact with private or enterprise about certain policy changes like the GDPR, which is getting everyone shaking in their boots. So, drawing from some of the lessons learned from the Obama administration, and any examples as well that you feel may be relevant to elaborate on, would you have any advice to, say, an Italian administration about how to overcome, how to break down or improve some of the improved connections in an area where, say, missing links in governance are quite profound? Do you have anything in particular?
Well, as I always said when I was in government, and I've continued to say out of government, I am always very careful when giving advice to people in other countries about how to do things, because obviously you have to. Yes, and obviously you always have to put things into the right political and cultural context for that country.
Yeah,
I will say that our experience was that, because cybersecurity cuts across so many different areas, including national security, economics, public health and safety, that trying to assign the mission of cybersecurity to like sort of one department or agency generally didn't work.
Yep.
And what we found in our context was what you really had to do was build the connections and work on enabling people to make those connections across departments and agencies, which is really uncomfortable for people because that obviously cuts against the bureaucratic grain.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely essential if you're going to if you're going to make progress on cybersecurity, because you've got to be taking all of those different factors into account when you're making policy or, you know, implementing policy. You want to be bringing all of those different aspects into the decision-making process. And just to make it even more complicated, much of the capacity resides in the private sector, particularly the technical capacity. And so you also have to figure out how to work with the private sector in some different ways than you probably have traditionally. Certainly, I would say that, you know, we even lack the vocabulary in the United States for what we want this relationship to be, because from the government perspective, they're not buying goods and services from the private. I mean, obviously they do buy cybersecurity services and technology, right? But this part of it is not really a contractual arrangement. It's not a regulatory arrangement of, you know, the government saying to cybersecurity vendors, you do this. It's we're trying to build a partnership between them. And so we get reduced to using like consultant speak of, you know, synergy and, you know,
buzzword bingo.
Buzzword, yeah. And we don't even really have the right vocabulary to describe what we want this relationship to be. And so certainly here in the United States, I would say that that's very much a work in progress of building that that cooperation, that collaboration between different government agencies and between the government and the private sector, and then between governments and the private sectors internationally.
And sorry, let's expand on that a bit more. When you say collaboration, in what sense do you mean? A threat intelligence collaboration? Do you mean information sharing? Do you mean policy driving?
Yes, it's a little bit of all of the above, right? Which is the you know, if you're trying to design. I mean, so a good example, like, right, is a good example is safety of autonomous vehicles.
Yep.
And, you know, in many ways, here in the United States, the U.S. government had gotten very used to the idea that it was the expert on safety regulations in the physical world for cars. And when they started, you know, cars started becoming more and more connected, having more and more computers, and some of those elements of the U.S. government started saying, great, we'll issue some new regulations in how to do computer security, they were not experts in cybersecurity.
Yeah.
And we really needed that part of the government to actually be consulting with the private sector cybersecurity community on what made sense, along with the auto manufacturers. And so that was kind of a new type of collaboration that none of the parties were really particularly used to. So that's one example. Another example is, how do you actually do collaboration between the government and the private sector when you want to actually disrupt what a bad guy is doing?
Mm.
So you've got a, you know, so take that Mirai botnet, or what recently came out in with a, you know, a name that does not sound fearsome at all, but called VPN filter, malware that infects routers and other types of devices like that. You want to do some coordination and say, okay, when we go public with some findings on this, we're going to coordinate with the government actually taking action against some of the websites that are involved. Mm. And some of the domains that are involved. Well, that's an uncomfortable place for everybody to be in. The private sector is actually communicating what they're, you know, what they would be doing ahead of time with the government. The government's actually having to give some indication of when it might take a law enforcement action so that things are coordinated. Well, that just makes everybody uncomfortable. But it's the only way to actually have the kind of impact that we want to against what our adversaries are doing.
Yeah.
And so we're building these, you know, the intelligence sharing, the operational collaboration. We're building it right now. And that's one of the things that makes this area so exciting, is that we're in the process of creating that.
It's still and a work in progress. Yeah.
It's pretty much a work in progress. It's also the thing that makes this area absolutely terrifying, is because you know, there's
none of it doesn't know what you're doing.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're making some of it. Even the experts are actually partially making this up as we go, right? And so it's both, you know, it's both exhilarating and frightening at the same time.
Yeah. But that's, look, sounds like a pretty good place to be at the, you know, the head of the curve, I guess. There are two more areas I'd like to explore. One is just reverting back, to that same question, but erasing the politics or the country out of it. Let's say you had advice to give in terms of developing those communication ties amongst interdepartmentally, because in your role as advisor for the Obama administration, being federal, I imagine you would have had to interact with basically everyone, federal, state, local, private sector, public sector, military, intelligence. Give us a sense of, you know, maybe an example or an anecdote that you have of bringing together and really sort of solidifying some of those, you know, obvious necessities of communication and trust that you would have to execute within that very complex sort of scenario.
Well, I think that, you know, one of the mechanisms that you're absolutely right. I mean, one of the mechanisms that we used was that we created interagency bodies within part of the advantage for the U.S. government is we've got a built-in mechanism for doing this within the federal government through the National Security Council staff. I mean, that's part of the reason the NSC was created, was to actually drive that kind of interagency coordination. And so we leveraged that to have a body that was made up of representatives from across the departments and agencies that worked on policy issues, sort of long-term legal issues, developing legislation to propose to our Congress, those sorts of things. And we also had something that we called the Cyber Response Group, which was the, like, something bad is happening and how do we organize the U.S. government's response to it.
Okay.
And there was some overlap between the two groups, but there was also differences in exactly who participated.
Was the response team, that sounds almost like the communications interface to public to say this is what happened, or was that more the incident response, how you handle it technically? What do you mean?
Well, it was more at the kind of, okay, from within an agency, this is how we're going to, you know, we're going to deploy the technical teams over here. This is, now let's all agree on what we're going to say about it to give to the communicators. Here's what, State Department, here's your talking points to go talk to our allies about this. So that's how we used that group, was to sort of coordinate all of those different activities across the U.S. government. And certainly, you know, I would say that human nature being what it is, I have definitely, I just have to believe that this also occurs in other societies, is that there was just no substitute for actually getting people to know each other.
Absolutely. Yep.
And you had to take the time to build the connections when there wasn't a crisis, so that when you did have a crisis, you weren't meeting people for the first time. And what I found was we went through this pattern over and over again with our critical infrastructure sectors, for example. So like the power sector or the financial services sector, which was initially, there was a lot of suspicion, a lot of mistrust between the sector and the government, and the sector not wanting to talk about cybersecurity issues because they were afraid that if they admitted that they had cybersecurity problems, that like the regulators would come down on them or customers would punish them. And we repeated this cycle over and over again, where everybody eventually began to realize that no, really the U.S. government really, you know,
wants to help. It's not there.
It wants to help. Right. And that that admitting that you have these issues did not immediately, you know, pose an existential threat, that in fact, being honest about that actually, and then enabled you to actually have an honest conversation about how to deal with it, that ended up making people feel much better off. So I think overall, you know, as the sectors have matured, you know, we've learned to have those conversations. But, you know, strangely, for an area that's so technologically dependent, it was still also dependent on just the people starting to learn how to interact with each other.
Yeah.
And yes, you need to use the technological tools, and the place where I am now, we focus on that. But at
the end of the day, it's just the humans. All the fancy tech that we create, and it's still the humans are still the weakest link in the chain, and we're still it's still the best way to access trust and develop good relations. Fascinating stuff. I'd love to move to the last section of the podcast and get a sense of it. I call it the shameless plug. For the listeners out there, we're not for profit, so this is where you know, you get to tell us everything about what you're doing currently with Cyber Threat Alliance, which again is quite an interesting body. So if you can get a sense of what you do there, and any speaking engagements or anything else that you've got in the pipeline, we'd love to know.
Well, sure. Well, thank you. So after I left government in January of 2017, I soon joined this organization, which is called the Cyber Threat Alliance, and we're a nonprofit ourselves, and we focus on enabling cybersecurity vendors and other highly technical companies to share cyber threat intelligence with each other in an automated way so that they can share that information at speed, at scale. But also to build those human-to-human connections that I was talking about, and to create that community of trust. And so really, we see our mission as both enabling our members to better protect their customers and clients because they get access to information they otherwise wouldn't have. We work on disrupting the bad guys at a more systematic level by trying to figure out ways to undermine, for example, the criminal business model. And we work to elevate overall cybersecurity across the digital ecosystem, for example, by me doing podcasts like this, where we're trying to do education and outreach to raise the level of you know, cyber competence and, you know, basic cyber skills across the ecosystem. So that's really the purpose of our organization. We're made up of 16 member companies currently. You can find them at cyberthreatalliance.org. Mm-hmm. And we're always in the market for, you know, new cybersecurity companies that want to join our alliance and both contribute to and get data from the alliance, but also participate in our ongoing activities. It's a really interesting effort because this is about how you actually in some ways change how the cybersecurity market works. You know, for many, many years, cybersecurity companies tended to compete on the basis of, I know something the other guy doesn't. Mm. And what we're realizing is that that's not the best way to have competition.
Not at all. No.
That instead, better competition comes from, I do better things with the data than my competitor. I understand your business better. I have better customer service. I have more effective analytics. That's where you want the competition to be occurring. That's a higher value competition to society as a whole. And that the data that underlies that should be shared broadly and used by everyone to make everyone better off. And that will be a net value add to society. And that's very much how we view what we do.
Fantastic. Well, we're, you know, right on board with you there. I think I wrote in the introduction email for the listeners when I wanted to conduct this podcast that I was shaking my head sadly and just thinking I'm just adding to the voices. But at the end of the day, we've all got to add to the voices so that you know, so that more and more people join join hands. I'll say it like a hippie.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and that is it is something that, you know, we've got to build that, both that awareness at the individual level, and that people can contribute and can make themselves better off as individuals. Organizations can make themselves better off as organizations. I always tell people that, like, if anybody tells you that they can give you 100% guarantee and make you 100% secure, they're selling you snake oil.
Yeah.
Or they don't know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But the flip side, it's not true that there's nothing you can do. And that
it's not,
you know, there are
the sand time. It's
Right. Yeah, there are things that you can do to make yourself more secure online, and you should do those things. And that's why I'm always interested in having these kinds of conversations to help people actually realize that and take action on that.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm sure, I'm sure the audience over in Europe will thoroughly enjoy this great exploration of your background. It's been, you know, a fascinating background, and glad to hear that you're in not-profit sector at the moment, trying to educate the people, vendors, and everything else. So I'd like to thank you very much, and thank you very much for contributing.
You're quite welcome. I'm happy to do it, and good luck with your podcast.
Cheers. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Welcome to our podcast at agendadigitale.eu.